welcome to those old and new. Anybody here for the first time? No, I saw you.
First time on Wednesday.
Oh, okay. Well, welcome. Didn't expect such a full house. So today, because Kokyo knows my birthday, it's the same birthday as his teacher, Tenshin Roshi, Reb Anderson, we have the same exact birthday, so Reb knows mine, and he knew it landed on a Wednesday, so he said a month or two ago that, okay, Richard, why don't you give a talk? It's your birthday, Wednesday. And usually when he asks something of me, I do it. Not always with great joy and anticipation, but it's an interesting experience to have to sit here and to take into account that I want to be able for this to be worthwhile for all of us. So please, everybody, relax, and I will open. It will be kind of like a meeting, less of a lecture, but a couple of points I'd like to make. And so I'll try to get those done as quickly as possible and then kind of set a question about practice and what's been happening with me, difficulties, and life with my practice. And then kind of open up so we can kind of examine practice a little bit. The first thing that has always fascinated me is our lecture chant. Even in 100,000 million kalpas, we won't hear such sacred and precious words. And I always go, yeah, but we hear them every Wednesday. You know what? How should we take this? I mean. We're not doing this for nothing. So, without getting too deeply into that, for that one, I suggest, since we do chant it at every lecture, it's worth just being with it a little bit, because it's a little bit of a koan in itself, and without like spoilers, because it's just me. I read it with the intention of. Not that I shouldn't have been paying attention up till now, paying attention and being in attention, but now somebody's taken the effort to put together a talk and sit in front of us, so this would be a good time to really listen and pay attention. But it's still a koan worth listening to. I wrote my own sort of alternative one, so this is the companion to the lecture chant, which I hear as pay attention. And the companion that I wrote is, an unsurpassable, penetrating, and perfect Dharma is always met with in each infinite moment. I vow to meet this moment alive, attentive, and calm with open hara and heart. It doesn't mean it's more, that's just another way in my mind of saying the same thing. It's not quite as koanish, you know. For whatever reason, you know, and as I'm sure Kokyo wanted me to do, once I knew I was going to give a talk, I started reading everything, going back into all my old stuff. I reread Gurdjieff, Uspensky, you know, the medicine way. I just, everything, what am I going to, reaching, looking at it. And I know, you know, he's smart. I know him well enough to know that's what he wanted me to do. And I realized I can't do all this stuff. I have to just pick a few things, and in reading virtually all the sutras, which incidentally, as I reread them really in a different way and almost for the first time, it occurred to me that these are all the teachings. You know, I think I really have been, for the number of years that I've been, since I even took the vow to wear a rakasu and to follow the precepts, I've always, the sutras like, well, let's read it, chant it, let's get through it, you know, and Some of them I really resonate with. Trust in Mind has always been. But it turns out, Sandra, all of them, as I read them, it seemed to me the whole teaching was just in our little black book. Whether it's true or not, this was an eye-opener for me. Those are real teachings. When we chant them and we really look at them and embrace them, they are wonderful, beautiful teachings. That's new to me. I've always been one who said, I'm not so much at the sutras, I just sit. I've changed. I don't feel that way. So everyone has under their seat, hopefully, everyone has a sutra book. And I think on page 11 you'll find the Metta Sutta, which, of course, is... No, I have them under everybody's seat. I did that with that in mind. Well, you know it by heart. That's why I didn't put one under yours. It looks like I might need one. I thought I had it here. I do. I had it written out. Now I don't have it here. So, okay. I just... this is a coming together with a wish, a kind wish, a heartful wish for ourselves and humanity. And I think when it's read that way, does everybody have one? Anyway, this loving kindness prayer, page 11. Thanks. Thanks for the light. Let me not overtalk it, but if we open our hearts and really, really send this out, the punchline of an old joke is it couldn't hurt. So let me just start it with Metta Sutta. This is what it should be accomplished by the one who is wise, who seeks the good and has attained peace. Let one be strenuous, upright, and sincere without pride, easily contented and joyous. Let one not be submerged by the things of the world. Let one not take upon oneself the burden of riches. Let one's senses be controlled. Let one be wise, but not puffed up, and let one not desire great possessions, even for one's family. Let one do nothing that is mean or that the wise would reprove. May all beings be happy. May they be joyous and live in safety. All living beings, whether weak or strong, in high or middle or low realms of existence, small or great, visible or invisible, near or far, born to be born, may all beings be happy. Let no one deceive another, nor despise any being in any state. Let none by anger or hatred wish harm to another. Even as a mother, at the risk of her life, watches over and protects her only child, so with a boundless mind should one cherish all living things, suffusing love over the entire world, above, below, and all around, without limit, so let one cultivate an infinite goodwill toward the whole world, standing or walking, sitting or lying down, during all one's waking hours, let one practice the way with gratitude, not holding to fixed views, endowed with insight, freed from sense appetite. One who achieves the way will be freed from the duality of birth and death. So when my mother found out that I was practicing Zen, Mom was a doer, and she didn't understand why one would just sit and do nothing. And she literally would say, "Well, why aren't you doing something? Why are you just sitting there?" And the answer came to me yesterday, as a friend told me a little Zen joke, which was, "Why are you just doing nothing? Why don't you just sit there?" So that's for a little
comment on that.
So I don't see how we can have a talk really without at least moving through and addressing the difficult world we live in. People call it the sixth extinction. People call it the Anthropocene extinction, one being caused by humanity. I'm not going to develop a talk around that. But for what it's worth, my sense of it is expressed by Pema Chodron. She says, if you're invested in security and certainty, you're on the wrong planet. And, you know, that sounds like kind of a little aphorism, but I think actually it's a very deep comment. Are we here by accident? These are questions. I don't have answers to this. But what that statement opens up is this a difficult planet that we had to come to learn what we have to learn as conscious beings? Is this our job? Is this not a mistake? And I simply offer that comment of hers and my taking it in, again, as a koan, and soaking with it, about the suffering, about almost the terrible, not about the terrible suffering in this world that is overwhelming. It's a question of how not to be overwhelmed and yet be able to move on with our lives. And I think each person has to come up with an answer of how to live in this difficult, really suffering-filled world. But maybe this is where we're meant to be. Maybe this is what we have. Maybe this is our challenge. Maybe in some way that enables you to move forward feeling like there was no other choice. This is what I came to be confronted with. Now let me see if I can find a way. And if you walk through that door, there's someone who is interested in finding a way and finding some spiritual path to walk that can center me in some way, that can set me on the path in a way that in whatever way I can, and I think this is incumbent upon us, each of us, to ask what that might be. A smile, being kind to the grocer, being an organizer, doing whatever work you feel that you have competence in and are strong in. It's a question I think we should, it's a worthwhile question I think we should ask ourselves. What can I do? And you don't have to, your job in my view is not to save the world. The first job is to do our practice as holy as we can and be as whole of a human being as we can and to bring that out in the world in whatever way we feel we can. Not feeling overwhelmed, but engaging what is it I can do within my limits. I will not save the world. The world may not be meant to be saved. It may always be here as a teaching school forever. I don't know. But I've come to practice, to learn how to walk this earth and this path in as beautiful and as sweet and kind and helpful a way as I can, and let that arise out of my practice. Let us see what that is. It might just be, it could be anything. It might mean you just come and sit. That's another, really kind of a koan. So I don't know if I'm being heard or not. Is this good enough? Okay, good. So I want to move through these as quick as I can and get to my own life. But here's another quote from a gentleman, Benjamin Zander. And he says, moving a little bit to another context or concept, in the measurement world, you set a goal and strive for it. In the universe of possibility, you set the context and let life unfold. Okay. The reason I chose that is because two things struck me. He's already raising the issue of the duality of the absolute measurement world is the reality, and the absolute is this universe of possibility, which, is it a duality or is it a seeming duality that is not its unity? But what really jumps out at me and interests me about this is, in the universe of possibility, you set the context and let life unfold. So what's the context? It's our practice. It's the six paramitas, the six perfections. It's right action. It's the precepts we vow to follow. But that context, for me, probably is never complete. It's never something we arrive at. So we are now totally spontaneous beings, reacting as beings spontaneously to everything that arises and that we meet. So as the beings and the human beings that we are, we practice, but always as some image is the idea that it would be a wonderful thing if I could be human and have practiced enough, my piano, my art, whatever it is, that it's become second nature to me. And now if I sit at the piano, or if I respond to what the world meets me with, I could do it spontaneously. And so my example always for me is my love of music and my practice with the piano. So to me, with any art or any taking on, you know, of any doing, you work as hard as you can, and I'll get into just how I move into this, but you practice, you develop your tools, you develop your abilities, what you can, so that you can express that particular art or whatever it is you're working on to the best of your ability. And ideally, you take it to where you've worked on it for the 10,000 hours, and it's become organic. So that now, when you sit at the piano, you don't have to think. Now you can just play. You just look at your fingers, and you can express whatever is in your heart and in your gut. And I don't see any way I can differentiate that from any practice in life. anything you take up to master, if you choose to go all the way with that in mind, or any way of living in life, period. We want to take it to a place where it becomes organic and spontaneous. And then it came up in Patrick's talk last week. It becomes this miraculous state where you don't need precepts, you don't need law, you don't need perfections, you just need the calm presence of your settled being that's come from sitting, practicing real introspection and self-analysis of who you are as this identified being. And really perfecting your work. In this case, if we're here, let's say we're working towards becoming familiar enough with this that becomes organic, it becomes spontaneous, and we don't need the teaching crutches. But for how many years or 10,000 hours or whatever do we need help, teachers, Sangha cannot do this without our friends and our community. This Sangha is necessary. I don't know anyone who thinks you can do this without the companionship of other people working with you. So that idea of the universe of possibility, you set the context and then it just arrives, then it unfolds. Let that be to whatever degree that I have a way of getting at this, because I read a book by Kenny Werner, who's one of my gods, music gods. You're not supposed to know who he is, but he's a great pianist and also a Zen practitioner. And the gist of what it was is, okay, Richard, if you're going to practice your piano first, before you sit down, when you sit down, you go into 5 minutes of meditation. And so you breathe. You've done this many times. You breathe enough to where you settle. You get into an alpha state. And in that state, you say, why am I playing the piano? Is this because I want to be admired and loved? Which is almost inevitable for anybody that does any kind of art. But you don't want to really have that as an overriding aspect of what you're doing at that piano at that time. So you ask yourself, in that quiet state, what am I going to do? Why am I doing this? Okay, if the ego wants to be loved, that's fine. And if it needs to be admired, that's fine. But what I want to choose is for me to be in relationship with this piano for the joy of this experience and of this communion with me and this instrument, so that this is fun. There's nothing, I don't have to get anywhere with this. It's simply this process of me. And what I'm calling practice is mean my curiosity is pushing me to learn new things. And each new thing that gets uncovered or that starts to be familiar is like this amazing, oh, I got this new lick. I got this new, understanding of this core. It's just, I'm doing it enough to where I don't, at some point after doing enough, it's in my bag. It'll come out. So that's my idea of practice, which I best relate to because of my way of, and then my way of practicing my love, my instrument, my music, playing and singing. And he goes further to say that during your practice, and I would say during your walking about in this infinite moment of life all the time, why not do this not only when you're at the piano, but he says, you've settled in, you've made some accommodation with how are you going to practice with a certain amount of joy and curiosity, and it shouldn't be work, it won't be work. In fact, if it is work, find something else. We don't need piano players per se. There are plenty of them. But if you are enjoying this, good, then proceed. What I want you to do, though, is, let's say every 10 minutes, I want you to stop. If you're practicing for, let's say, an hour or two, let's say an hour, every 10 minutes, stop. This is a practice in our lives. It has to be, should be. Stop. Don't continue. Don't just get lost in your stop your practice and do the same thing you did when you sat down. No, what you're going to do is you're going to find that your shoulders are like this. Always. You always. So drop your shoulders because somehow tension developed in this 10-minute period. So take a breath, drop your shoulders. Take a few minutes. Breathe. Center. Readdress this ridiculous Rube Goldberg thing of a piano. And start enjoying it again. But don't just push through. Keep taking time and space to recenter. It's not a new concept. But having embraced that, my practice, is nothing like it used to be. It used to be a burden. It used to be onerous because I had to accomplish something to be good enough to meet the expectation, blah, blah, blah. And now that's gone. Only in my old age, you know, so I have to stay healthy and live a few more years because now I can do this. Couldn't do it as a young, egotistical, you know, young man. And probably the last thing I want to address before I just get into the difficulties I'm having in this practice and with the things I want to get to, is the idea I want to actually put this out, to this idea of if you do the turning of the mirror around, if you look inward to see what's happening with this ego, this libido, this id, this identified personality. What am I doing? A very, very quick story. I had joined a choir that asked me to come and even wanted to pay me because I was like a ringer. I was in another choir, but they knew I could do bass at least, and they had lost a bit. And I said, yes, I would do it. But I was in there. I knew I'm in there because they think I'm good. And so we rehearsed. I kept saying, don't worry. You know, I came in late, so I had to really get this. I came in and they gave me this really great solo of a song that I had learned, and it was an awesome solo. I'm tempted to just almost speak it to you just so you know how awesome it is. I will. So I got this solo, and in this song, Nina Cried Power by Hozier. If you want to hear a great song, it's a great song. And I get the solo, and I could cry power. Power has been cried by those stronger than me. Straight into the face that tells you to rattle your chains if you love being free. I got that. That was my solo, and I had this great, powerful. And when it came time to do it, I went up, which I don't usually do. I mean, because I perform regularly, and I've done lots of theater. Going up means I went dry. I said, I could cry, power, power has been cried by those more stronger than me. Straight into if you love being free. And I thought, man, that whole beautiful, great thing I got. And they were expecting this guy, this big pro bass guy to come in and kill it. And I went away just feeling so horrible. And then, I said, all right, just stop feeling horrible. Let's just take a look at it. Is that because you're getting senile? Maybe. I thought, well, is it? I said, no, it's not. It's because, sure enough, in that position of people thinking highly of you and expecting you to really knock this thing out of the park, your ego got the best of you. And I had to just say, okay, you won that one. You won't get me again because I caught you. But I was trying to, I really wanted to impress all the folks that were singing with me and the people listening and show them, man, that guy knocked this thing out of the park, and boy, is he a good singer. And it was clear to me. And the question, I'm glad I have the willingness to do that, because once I clarified, it was like, okay, I know what happened. You know, it's not fun going up. It's kind of a nightmare. It's called the actor's nightmare, actually, or the singer's nightmare. You know, but there are reasons you do it, and if you find out it's because of your ego, that's something to work with. If it's because of your senility, you're done. I don't know that you can do too much of that, you know. But I concluded it was not. I mean, I won't do any more theater because of, I can't remember lines. You know, so, but that's okay, I'm comfortable with that. But going up because of your ego is an interesting thing, you know. And so my question is, among us, I mean, in order to do what I call the work, and a lot of the work has to do with this, is there's what many people call a normal attention, which is our walking daily attention, which people like Gurdjieff or most writers of theology and philosophy will say is essentially asleep, habituated. This is what we're calling the first attention. It's just the one that just is basically habit, and we're not really questioning it. And that there is also within us a second attention. So if you're reading Carlos Castaneda, it's the tonal, which is the world as it manifests, and the nahual, which is the mysterious unknown world. You know, the manifest and the absolute, you know. And in my mind, and this is not a truth I'm putting out that someone must absorb, it's something I'm asking, who among us feels like, the example I'll give and then I'll ask is sometimes if I, at night, and I can't go to sleep and I'm just going over my past failures in my life and I'm killing myself and I'm hating myself for it. You loser, what, look at this at your age and what is it? What has this life amounted to? And that failure and that failure. And then, if it gets so bad I can't take it anymore, I move my conscience over and I consult a presence that I've known is there. It's a presence that I know that I take for that situation as the parent who will, in this case, let me go to sleep by addressing this child, the ego, who is ruining my night, keeping me awake, and none of that making me suffer about being a complete failure, and the circumstances and occasions are endless. One leads to another. And the parent hasn't bought into that at all. He takes that child and he says, I understand you're suffering and I understand you feel like you failed in these many things. First of all, I love you. You're okay as you are. And here's something I want to tell you. Those things, when they occurred, any of those things that you're calling failures, at the time that you interacted and had that experience in your life, I promise you, with what you knew and the tools you had available at that time, you did the best you could, son. You did the best you could. That's why you don't need to go back and punish yourself about it. Because there was no other thing you could do. If you could have done the thing you wish you did, you would have done it. Okay? Okay, my son. Okay, rest. Take it easy. You did the best you could. Always remember that. When you start falling into the... This is me talking to myself. So I'm asking, do most of us here feel like we have that other voice? That other attention? Yes. Well, I guess it's better to say to some people feel like, you know, I've never felt like I have that other attention in my head. I mean, would anybody have the real nerve to say, no, I'm not aware of that in my consciousness, of this other. It's not enough, it's a mystery. We don't know what it is. People always have a name for it and they seem to, but for me it's like, I have no idea what that is. But I know it's something that's objective, loving, unconditional, and that I can trust. I'm putting it out there, but I take it back. You don't have to respond to it. I fully trust that whether you know it or not, that second attention is present, and that's a tool, that's a helper. That's where we're moving towards in practice, so that more and more of our life It's not lit habitually. But we've moved through practice, through sitting, through analysis, our own self-analysis, with that observer. So you can't do self-analysis. You can't look at yourself. Who's looking? It's not the identified person. They're just busy being lost. So even when you just think into yourself, well, about I'm looking at, what's am I feeling in my body? That's the observer, the witness. Okay. Yeah. I feel like this is a very crucial, a crux in our practice, is our whatever ways you have or can think of or conceive of, I leave that to the individual because I don't have time to go into it, of moving attention from this, that failure, upset person to the habitual person to the person that's basically sleep. What ways do we have in our practice to, at every possible point, shift our attention to that witness, to that observer, to that place of wisdom? I don't want to call it our true nature. You could call it what you want. To me, it's a mystery. I don't know what it is, but it's a place where we can live. It's a place that can guide us and help us live in a much more alive and a rich way. So I present that question without trying to lecture and give you... I have ideas. It's for another talk. How do I, in my practice, throughout the day, in my sitting, in my walking, in my stillness, which of course is the beginning, finding the stillness. That's always finding that alpha, and then moving my life into this second place of attention that changes everything and every experience in the world into a richer, more alive, less judgmental, without opinion, with forgiveness, with gratitude. It's to me the work. There are two actual attentions, and I can begin to develop this attention. I remember Gene giving whole charts about this that were sometimes a bit overwhelming, but really talked about the same thing of moving the attention away from the habitual and to the more alive and the more awake, and discussing, it's up for discussion at another time. How do we do that? How do you do that? What are some ways to do that?
I think breathing helps with you're interrupting the negative conversation with the breath.
Absolutely.
And then it opens up for something.
A space. That's talking about stopping the world, stopping your life for a moment to take a breath. That maybe that becomes a habit almost in our daily life. We don't wait to come to the zendo. That continually, you know, we keep checking and dropping our shoulders, checking and dropping, breathing. So I think that's probably the first. But there are, yeah. Yes, Kathy?
Just being aware that the obsessive ego voice isn't the only one, is in and of itself. You're beginning, you know, whether it's something that you do to go from here to here, whether it's just actually recognizing, oh, this isn't all there is, or oh, there's another way, or oh, I don't have to think this way. And that was one of my first insights in this practice, was I don't have to think every thought that comes up in my head.
Absolutely.
And then once that is entertained, then there is the spaciousness that is rather pleasant.
Yes.
A pleasure to relax it.
Right, and we don't even... doesn't have to even be named a second attention or anything. It doesn't need any name, but just to know, yeah, that. Well, I don't have much time, but I can say what we can just. My question for myself right now is, whatever, given my life circumstances, here's a situation. I'm sitting at the, and this has to do with renunciation and with simplifying life and with getting to do the things you want to do in life and the resistance that comes up. And so I'm sitting watching TV. Okay. I'd like to just throw the TV out. Don't have the guts to do it yet. So there's the TV and I'm sitting, I'm watching. There's two things that I have planned to do that I want to do. One is to get to the piano. And the interesting part of both of these is whenever I do finally get to the piano, I'm in love. It's not like I'm thinking, oh, I got to do that job. No, I'm sitting there watching, deadening myself, watching stuff that I don't need to watch, resisting going to do a thing that I know once I'm seated there, I'll be happier than anything, than any other. It's, you know, and then also just, I know I need to take a walk. I need to do, I need to move. And I know when I got myself to do that walk, I'm so happy. I'm moving. It's, in other words, these are things. It's not like taking out the garbage when I was a kid or something, you know, or doing something I didn't want to do. These are things I want to do, and I know when I'm doing them, I'm happy. And here I am sitting with the resistance to doing it, watching TV. What is that all about? And what are the, what, you know, I don't have time now. It's 20, but maybe for our next talk or even just to carry again, what tricks, what any tool, any kind can I use to break this inertia and just get me to, boom, turn it off and go sit at the piano? I have one way that I'll say, and then I'll invoke it, if I remember to invoke it, I have a 1, 2, 3 that I've used all my life. And when the word 3 comes into my voice, I could be standing on a cliff, I jump. I stop the world. It's something that just became a part of my repertoire. And I don't, and I tend to choose, I think, not to use it because I just don't want to. I'm still, but if I do it, the TV's going off. That's one I don't think, that's probably not common to most people. But that is my question, you know, one that I think it's time, we're, you know, past. But Kathy, did you have a thought about it?
We can continue the conversation at tea.
That's yeah.
Awesome.
Or.
When we, you know, get excited and we are out of time, we can certainly continue.
We can.
And it's
a question that I pose because it's a problem I'm living with, and if anybody else is, you know, we can always talk about it. You know, not even at tea, we can have a conversation about it anytime. For me, it is because it's everything. Last time for one more comment. Did you have one last?
Yeah, the way that I look at it with myself is kind of, you know, this symbol. Because of the way that society is geared at this point, and we're neglecting the creative aspects, you know, that are nourishing and allowing for us to be in clearer space within ourselves and empower us to find like our true voice and who we are. And, you know, to be aware of, you know, like to be sitting there and you're observing yourself watching TV and you're also observing yourself playing the piano, you know, that it's just the momentum of getting into the better space, you know, and then changing, getting rid of that habit of sitting at the TV in the first place, and then eventually, like, you're at the piano constantly, that the TV is just, what's the point? It's out the door.
And I want it to be out the door.
And then, you know, get rid of supporting industries that are, you know, and little by little, it's just like,
no, thank you. That's the process of thinking that stuff through. It's a whole world of. Thanks, folks. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I to end them. Dharma gate are boundless. Hey, Val, do I?